This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. And take a look at the calendar, won't you?
It's Tuesday, April 30, 2013.
I mean, how did we get here? For us, it's actually 5 years since we began doing this daily radio program. That was a real life changer for all of us here. Our show was, in fact, the culmination of efforts to start something in public radio that began many years before that, but you don't need to know those details. Look around, though. In 2013, there's a raging global argument over downsizing government. There's war in Afghanistan, tensions over Iran. China's economy is carrying the entire world, it seems. 2013's headlines may have begun in some shifts in the world that began a long time ago, say 1979. Village People, number 8 song in 1979. Even that might have been a hint of things to come in the headlines even today. We'll talk about that a little later this hour. Big year for you, 1979. A historian will talk later this hour about his 79 theory later in the show. He won't be mentioning the Village People. But what is your year?
1985 changed my life when doctors said that I had a life expectancy of 47 years. I turned 48 this year. It changed my world to have them tell me that my life would be shortened. So I did everything that I wanted to do and then some.
In 2007, I quit my job and moved to Asia and met the love of my life, Chris.
Nice. 85, 07. Nobody said 2001. And I'm glad about that. Although some folks who investigate terrorism for a living certainly had their lives turned upside down in that year. We'll talk about whether more than a decade of major investments in the war on terror have brought us much in the way of security in 2013. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your big year. But first, 2013 is surely a big year for Jason Collins, even forgetting for a moment that his team, the Boston Celtics, is in the playoffs.
You know how you go through anger, denial, and all, you know, it's just... But when you finally get to that point of acceptance, there's nothing more beautiful. And just allowing yourself to, you know, really be happy and be comfortable in your own skin.
A very relieved-sounding NBA player, Jason Collins, on ABC's Good Morning America. His first broadcast statement after he announced publicly for the first time yesterday that he is gay. His cover story is on newsstands everywhere fronting Sports Illustrated. A player who might never have made it to the cover, but for this. There's been considerable commentary online and from NBA fans watching their own playoff fortunes. Students at Montclair State University in New Jersey, who grew up as fans of Collins, told us they still stand behind him.
No one should really care. Who cares? You know, he could produce on the field or on the court. It shouldn't matter what he does outside of that.
I think it's a bold move. I'm not surprised that there's gay athletes, but I give him a lot of credit to come out because he's going to take a lot of criticism.
Well, of course, it's a surprise if somebody just comes out, but I think it's good what he's doing for future gay athletes or even gay athletes who are there just scared to come out.
Fear? Well, it was support pouring in from fans at last night's Nets game in New York City.
I commend him. I'd rather for him to come out than to live with it inside of him, eating him up. That's about it. Everybody has to live.
And hopefully in the... Jason Collins is somewhat of a pioneer that other players will be willing to come out now.
On the line with us now is another pioneer, Ezra Tuaolo. Back in 2002, he came out 2 years after he retired from the NFL and 3 years after he'd made it to the Super Bowl with the Atlanta Falcons. Ezra joins us from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Welcome.
Aloha. Hey, John. How are you?
It's great to talk to you. What do you think the barrier is that Jason Collins broke down? A personal barrier or a larger societal barrier?
I think both, you know, a personal barrier for himself, you know, stepping out into the truth and being able to just be himself. And then also a larger barrier, you know, breaking down stereotypes of what a gay male should, I guess, look like, you know, because back in the days and stuff, it was that a gay male was that kid that used to get beat up on the playground or used to get harassed, you know, in school. But definitely he has definitely broken down some stereotypes and stuff.
Is that something you worried about on the playing field during your years with the NFL?
You know, back in the days when I played about a decade ago, yes. You know, there was a little bit of that fear of, you know, someone taking out my knees or there was a bounty on me or something about, you know, the gay guy. But we are living in different times now. And now when a player lashes out and, you know, uses the word gay, faggot, or queer in a negative term, you know, they're held accountable. I mean, I'm also talking with coaches as well. You know, it's not right. Anytime you use those words and you discriminate another human being, it's definitely not right.
But we're not talking too terribly long ago. I mean, the late 90s, the early 2000s. Yeah. I mean, you were worried that a bounty would be on you, that people suspected you might be gay, and you had to really, you know, play the straight and narrow.
Yeah, but, you know, back then, John, we didn't really have the conversations that we do now. It wasn't on the table to be discussed at all. So through this short time, you know, of 10 years, it's definitely, you know, been on the table. I think the media also did a fantastic job of, you know, showing like positive role models for the LGBT community. But also, you know, it's been a hot topic on the political ground for the longest time, gay marriages. So it's definitely been talked about.
So where do you think this goes? I mean, is there like a specific product endorsement? Is there a whole kind of gay constituency that will have very specific bonding with the teams depending on their personnel and their sexual orientation?
No, I just think it just proves and stuff about, you know, an individual being able to be himself. And, you know, what people don't realize, when I played in the NFL for 9 years, I played with depression. I played with stress. I played with suicide tendencies. I played with fear. And, you know, it's one of those things where when I say let's create a safer environment for a player in the NFL, I'm not saying different locker rooms or different, you know, or we wanted more money or whatever. What I'm talking about is creating a safe environment so a player that's in the closet don't have to deal with those things that I just mentioned, you know, so he could play to the best of his ability, so he could be free of all of that and play to his best potential. Like I said, we are living in a different time now. I mean, and, you know, it's time that we move forward from all of this.
So I'm looking at your resume here. I'm wondering, what's your best year? Is it the year you decided to come out, or is it the year you went to the Super Bowl?
You know, my best year, I have to say, is when I adopted my twins, my two beautiful children. That was probably the best year. And then, of course, I would have to say 2002, when I stepped out into my truth and was able to, you know, be honest with myself. You know, it was just amazing. From living with a crippling secret all my life, it was just awesome to share who I truly was with everyone.
So, Ezra, Super Bowl is a distant third.
Yeah, distant third is Super Bowl. And you know what? It's funny what people don't realize. And, you know, I was partnered with my partner for 5 years during that time. And it wasn't as glamorous and fun as maybe my straight colleagues would have enjoyed, how they enjoyed it. We were definitely living in the shadows. I couldn't introduce him to any of the teammates, the coaches, their wives. You know, it was one of those things where we had to keep it secret. So how can you enjoy something that's so amazing when you're living in the shadows? And, you know, and it definitely hurt when I saw, you know, when I saw wives come in with their kids, introducing them to coaches and players and all of that. And here I am, you know, when Mitchell, my boyfriend at the time, comes walking in, we have to hide everything. So it wasn't the highlight that everyone, for myself, what's so pathetic about it is that I can never get that back.
Well, you've taken some steps, that's for sure. You do a lot of work on anti-bullying now. What was the year that you adopted your twins, so we know the name of the year?
2000. Yeah, 2000. And that was probably the pinnacle of why one of the biggest reasons why we came out is because we came out for our children. We wanted our kids to know that their fathers were proud of who they were. It was difficult raising our children in the closet. And we just wanted to make sure, just simple things like the school they went to, that people understood that they had two dads, and, you know, and it was a safe environment for our children.
All right. Well, Ezra Tuaolo, thanks so much. And congratulations, for all of your success and courage echoed by the decision of, Jason Collins. Anything particular to say, to or about Jason before we go?
You know, I really commend him, and definitely what he's done is very courageous. And, you know, there's a bigger picture here. It's not just about him coming out or anything. It's about all these kids that he's become a role model for. You know, it's funny that we're talking about this, and this is the hot topic and the big topic in, you know, in society today across the nation. But what's the hot, should be the hot topic is there, we have children that are killing themselves from bullying. And that should be the hot topic. That's how we should, you know, that's who we should focus a lot of our energy on, trying to save these kids from committing suicide. So, I mean, but he definitely, like I said, it's in the bigger picture, because the more role models that the LGBT community has that comes out, the better for our youth today.
Ezra Tuaolo, thanks so much.
All right, aloha.
Ezra Tuaolo played in the NFL for 9 years. He retired in 2000 and came out as gay in 2002. What a pioneer. 2 years of huge significance for him.
From the brim to the dregs, it poured sweet and clear. It was a very good year.
And a dreadful song. Thank you, Frank. All this hour, we're asking you for the year that changed your life.
The year 2008 completely changed my life because I was able to be a Rotary Youth Exchange student in Slovakia. My senior year of high school, I was able to spend a year with three different families in a different country and a different culture, and it was absolutely incredible, and it changed a lot of my views in life.
That's a great story. Here's one from Florida. 1988, I went sailing with a friend and within that year quit my aerospace career. Have been sailing around the Pacific and Caribbean ever since. Complete change from the MBA lifestyle in aerospace that I had planned. Wouldn't trade a second of it. Oh, and 1982, it was the year I came out, finally. Thanks so much for that. Fairbanks, Alaska sent us this. When I first enlisted in the United States Army in 1995. New York City, 2005, I realized I no longer believed in organized religion, left my Orthodox Jewish lifestyle completely, and divorced my wife. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What year means the most to you and why? Or you can just tweet us at The Takeaway. Later on, we'll discuss why this year matters so much. 1979, big year candidate, folks.
Overseas today, here in Tehran, the Ayatollah Khomeini, the Iranian religious leader, has come home. He left this land 15 years ago, a critic of the Shah. He returns today, a national hero. Some would say a messiah.
Peter Jennings of ABC News describing the homecoming for Ayatollah Khomeini that evolved into a confrontation between the U.S. and Iran.
The government of Iran must recognize the gravity of a situation which it has itself created and the grave consequences which will result if harm comes to any of the hostages.
Carter was a one-term president in part because of the hostage crisis. An inflation rate of 13% didn't help. Double-digit interest rates. Tough year for the U.S. in 1979, but a transformative year for China. Not that the rest of the world was paying much attention. Deng Xiaoping at the Communist Party Congress saying, "To be rich is glorious." More about 1979 being a pivotal moment in our own modern history. Author Christian Carroll joins us later this hour. We're just getting started on 79. So keep thinking about your biggest year. We want your stories for later this hour. But here's something that we struggle with every day on this program. Is there a correlation between lack of sleep and an ability to focus? Sounds obvious. When you're tired, you have more trouble concentrating, more trouble remembering, more trouble following through on tasks. This intuitive relationship between sleep and focus, though, may have something to do with a huge rise in the diagnosis of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which now reportedly affects 11% of school-aged children. There is also, did you know about this, a broad scientific consensus that kids are sleeping for roughly an hour less than they used to, a sleep time that has crept steadily downward for many decades. Joining us now is Wetzel Thacker, who is a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at the NYU School of Medicine. This is not just a random set of occurrences here, and welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much. I've been seeing adults for ADHD diagnoses, trained in it at NYU for several years now. And what I came to pick up on is that there's this last frontier of medicine, which starts when we fall asleep. It's a big mystery of what happens when we sleep to most people and to even many doctors. And so once I started looking into it and asking patients the right questions, I found out that up to 50% of my patients who come to me to want, you know, when they wonder if they have an ADHD diagnosis, up to 50% of them seem to have sleep dysfunction, and about 25% of them actually have a diagnosable sleep condition when I get them tested.
What's fascinating about your work is that it sounds to me as though it's pretty rare for doctors ever to seek information about sleep habits, even though it's something that we do every day.
That's true. I think part of the issue is sleep medicine even is in its infancy. I think I've been able to look at patterns and results from sleep studies that even the reports of the sleep tests don't come to the same conclusions. And then I might look up different studies and try to triangulate the right information to come up with a conclusion, test it out with a patient, and it seems to work. The biggest issue being many people seem to have delta sleep deficits, which are the deep restorative type of sleep. A common misconception is that people need REM sleep. I mean, REM sleep is nice, but you really, really need delta and deep sleep. It helps the body regenerate, helps the mind regenerate. And it seems to be the only type of sleep that if you deprive laboratory animals of, they die. So it's very important to life.
Let me ask you a couple of naive questions, if
sure.
you don't mind. Is this a kind of an issue where if everyone's sleep were to be restored, that they would bounce back and be able to focus like normal? Or does prolonged sleep deficits and sleep problems produce patterns in the brain that are sort of stuck in a lack of focus, an ADHD kind of configuration?
It's a great question. It does seem to be complicated. I don't know that we have studies to bolster one way or the other. My experience in practice is definitely if we catch the sleep problem that develops and we catch it early, I've had cases where I've gotten people off of either an antidepressant or ADHD medication because, for example, we aggressively had their apnea treated if it had onset in the last year. It does get more complicated when it's been more than a year, 6 months to a year. And there are some studies in kids that when they have sleep disordered breathing as an infant, it creates behavioral problems later in life, even when that sleep issue is now normalized. So there could be some permanence to it if it goes undetected, untreated for very long.
So would you recommend that doctors really pay attention to sleep habits at an early age in children as a way of anticipating and predicting behavioral problems down the line?
I think every pediatrician, internist, and anyone who sees general patients, psychiatrists included, needs to survey, at least ask a few questions about sleep and the satisfaction with sleep patterns. I think one of the issues is many patients don't bring it up because they just feel, okay, maybe I'm fatigued because I work too hard, or, you know, I got, you know, they normalize it. They don't consider it a clinical problem. I've had people stunned to realize that they have sleep apnea. You know, they think they might snore once in a while, and they get tested, and you know, that their apnea is off the charts. So I think it's a dual problem. It's not asked enough by clinicians, and it's not brought up enough by patients.
What do you say to some of the clinical disagreeers out there who say lack of sleep does not cause ADHD, for instance, and while getting more sleep is probably a good idea, it doesn't get to the core question of ADHD?
My thoughts in my article was not meant to imply that all cases of ADHD are sleep disorders. But it's sizable. And when I started looking up the data on it, for example, in kids, there's more data than adults. But the studies show, you know, like I said, my practice was 50%. Some studies show 40. Some studies show 80% of kids have some identifiable sleep dysfunction when they have an ADHD diagnosis. So, I'm not ready to say what causes what. Some people say that being a hyperactive kid makes them restless when they're sleeping, and that can interrupt delta sleep, versus kids who have trouble breathing. Their kids can have narcolepsy. Kids can have restless leg type symptoms. All of those things, you know, detract from the deep sleep that's necessary, which has implications for daytime and, you know, school time symptoms.
So the takeaway at the very least would be pay attention to sleep deprivation issues in thinking about ADHD, even if the treatment imperatives aren't completely clear.
Correct. I would say if there's a fatigue component, if there's a sleep component observed by parents or by, you know, bed partners, often the person doing the sleeping doesn't realize what's going on when they're sleeping. I think more needs to be inquired about in terms of sleep rather than just purely from an ADHD perspective.
Vatsal Thakkar is a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at the NYU School of Medicine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So look back at the calendar now. 2007, there was an important year for the U.S. economy. The year the financial crisis began and the recession right behind it, it was also a dreadful year for one of our listeners in Colorado. 2007, as a single mom, when I lost my home, my significant other left me, that was a rock-bottom year for me. I was crushed in despair and broken. The economic recession produced many stories like that. 4.6 million stories, you might say. That's the number of the so-called long-term unemployed in the United States. In some cities, that unemployment rate is over 15%, and these trends will persist. For some sectors, they will deepen, even if the outward economic numbers bounce around like the stock market is rising right now. Crime remains at its lowest level since the early 1970s in most places, but the 70s was not a happy decade for the U.S. economy. Does today look like 1975, the year I was laid off from my last factory job in Western Michigan? The 70s may be a period of disinvestment that we will see in this decade. Patrick Sharkey joins us, associate professor of sociology at New York University, the author of Stuck in Place, Urban Neighborhoods and the End of Progress Toward Racial Equality. Patrick, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What did the 2007 recession set in motion that leads you to suspect that for a lot of places in the United States, it's going to be grim for a while?
Well, the conditions were just incredibly severe. We had not only the high rates of joblessness, unemployment, but also new concentrations of poverty, meaning the poor living together in the same communities, creating extremely high poverty neighborhoods, both in the cities and in the suburbs. We then had that housing crisis, which hit as well. This is typically a recipe for the start of a period of violent crime. If there are neighborhoods that are emptying out, that are becoming blighted, along with rising concentration of poverty. And then to top it off, we're in a period where more people are now coming out of prison than moving in. And this is the first time this has been true for several decades. The people coming out of prison tend to locate in a small number of neighborhoods that are already distressed. So this is kind of a recipe for urban crisis, for a disaster in the most disadvantaged communities across the country.
What does disinvestment mean for the neighborhoods that you're most concerned about?
You know, I'm not sure if disinvestment is the best word. It is because we invest in disadvantaged communities, meaning there are resources that go into disadvantaged communities. What they go to is what's problematic. They primarily our federal resources and our state resources go toward, I'd say the largest investments are toward locking people up. And that's not an exaggeration. We spend an enormous amount of money to police and to imprison young people. And this is concentrated. You know, there's a really well-known center here in New York called the Justice Mapping Center that actually shows the expenditures that are spent block by block in New York City. And it's just astounding. So there's a tremendous amount of resources that are spent on disadvantaged neighborhoods, but it's going toward locking people up. It's not going toward investing in those families and those communities.
And would you say that those investments are actually making the gap between the wealthy and the poor wider?
I think they are. I think there are, you know, communities across the country rely on federal investment, whether it's investment in the transportation system, whether it's subsidies for home mortgages, whether it's taken for granted institutions like the schools and the police. Every community across the country relies on intense investment from states and from the federal government. And some communities don't get it. And I think urban neighborhoods across the country since the war on poverty have not received sustained, consistent consistent investment, particularly from the federal government.
Right. Well,
and this has really exacerbated inequalities across American communities.
And the federal government has a role to play here, that's for sure. Patrick Sharkey, Associate Professor of Sociology at New York University, author of Stuck in Place, Urban Neighborhoods and the End of Progress Toward Racial Equality. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. What if you started with something in life, not nothing, thinking about this inequality economically, and you could build from there as you made your way in the world? What if in your pivotal year, or turning 18, 22, even 30, something set aside for you was suddenly available to assist you in your bold plans, to give you security, a cushion for the uncertain years ahead, a boost when you needed it most? Some people, of course, start with plenty, and the rich usually end up ahead of the game years later. Numerous economic indicators say that the gap between rich and poor is more alarming. The gap between black and white is growing. Yesterday, urban policy scholar Derek Hamilton argued for spreading the nest egg around to try and narrow the success and wealth gap.
But we propose something bolder, something that would be larger in endowment and more progressive, so that if you're born into the most wealth-poor family, you would get the larger endowment that could mature when you become an adult and use towards some asset-enhancing endeavor. The idea is to protect the children from any decision that their parent might make with regards to savings and also whatever wealth position that they're born in at birth, so that we truly can have a level playing field.
Using endowments to level the economic playing field. It was a provocative idea when Derek Hamilton spoke about it on the program yesterday. We wanted to continue the conversation. Ann Price joins us, Program Director for Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative. What do you think of that endowment idea, Ann?
Hi, John. Thanks for having me. I think that Professor Hamilton puts forward a very thought-provoking proposal, because what he does is he basically addresses the underlying issue affecting wealth disparities, and that is family inheritance. And with his proposal, he's equaling the playing field for those who get an inheritance, which many people don't, for those children who will never, ever receive an inheritance, which also puts them kind of at a disadvantage for opportunities to invest in a business or to fund their college education. And so his proposal does take out the factor of the status in which you're born into. So that's what makes it a very interesting proposal.
Would you say that an endowment would take the place of social welfare programs and actually represent some economies there, as Derek Hamilton suggested yesterday?
Well, certainly with that kind of endowment, you could start to consider whether you need the range of social programs that are offered. But I would contend that we can't just provide help to individuals and think about the fact that institutions have a role to play in the outcomes in people's lives. So, for example, if a person got an endowment and had $20,000-$30,000 when they matured at 18, would that be enough for them to actually be able to finance their college education? What would that actually mean, given the rising cost of college? There still needs to be put in place a number of protections for people to protect their wealth, and to still come to grips with some of the rising costs of education, for example, and the fact that there's still predatory lending practices that tend to siphon people's wealth. So we can't give up on those efforts to actually address those structures.
What endowment level would be good, starting at 20,000 at birth and then growing it to age 18 where it vests, where it might be something like 100,000, 150,000? What do you think is a number here that would actually be meaningful?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. Unlike income, when we have kind of thresholds, what is a wealth threshold? But certainly someone that had some wealth holdings of $50,000, $75,000 certainly puts them on a path to be able to make decisions about their future and invest in their future, either through business ownership or education. So, of course, that would give someone a great head start to the rest of their lives. And to be able to put that money away also for retirement, that's a big deal.
A five-figure investment there, according to Ann Price, Program Director of the Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative, a nonprofit based in Oakland, California. Ann, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Since September 11th, has America been well defended in the war on terrorism, or simply lucky? And therefore, was the Boston bombing earlier this month a tactical victory for terrorists or a lucky break for some nasty, bitter criminals? Well, former Attorney General John Ashcroft might say that law enforcement and government vigilance has kept terrorism at bay in the U.S. It was certainly his mission after the attacks of September 11th.
The president turned to me and said, in my direction anyhow, he said, never let this happen again.
But other national security experts would say we are swimming in war on terror data and vigilance after billions spent to upgrade U.S. intelligence, and it's hard to know if any of it has really changed our threat level.
You can look, if you're objective, at all of this money and all of this effort and say, what would have happened if we hadn't done that? And in almost every case, nothing would have happened.
The familiar voice there of Richard Clark, former National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Counterterrorism, one of the many security experts interviewed by Frontline. Top Secret America, 9/11 to the Boston bombings. It airs tonight. The documentary features the reporting of Dana Priest, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The Washington Post and co-author of Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. She joins us now. Welcome, Dana.
Good to be here, John.
So let's talk a little bit about what we've bought with all of this national security, war on terror money. What does it look like? Where could I go see it? And how does it bear on preventing the incident that we all saw unfold in Boston earlier this month?
Well, you can't go any one place to see it. It's really a scramble of databases and organizations and private companies that do work for the government. We found 1,200 federal government organizations doing counterterrorism work at the top secret level and 2,000 companies that helped them do that. And really what happened after 9/11 is a blank check was given. People were so worried about what was here. All these different organizations were stood up, the Department of Homeland Security, the Director of National Intelligence, the National Counterterrorism Center. And it almost became, it did become so big of a organizational chart that much was not shared with other people because the thing was just crushing on its own weight. I think that still is the case to some degree. If you look at the Boston case, we don't think that all the pieces, now they might be small pieces, but all the pieces that were available on the older brother in particular who had gone to Russia were brought together. And then you have to say, well, what would have happened if they had been brought together? Would it have mattered? Would it change the course? But we can say from what we know already that all those pieces were not brought together and they should have been.
And I guess I'm trying to find a metaphor here to describe what we have. We have an enormous amount of data, lots of data points. But someone once told me that the way we underscore its significance, it almost amounts to opening an enormous book and finding every line underlined, as though there's a lot of scrutiny of the data, but we've lost our ability to distinguish what's important and what's not. Did the Tsarnaevs fall into this kind of vigilance trap?
Could have been. Now, I think that analogy is a really good one, and it applies in particular if you have a lay reader or someone with not great a lot of experience in a particular country or a particular terrorist group looking at that book. But the National Counterterrorism Center, which sits over in McLean, Virginia, is supposed to be the place where top-level analysts who are specialists in a place like Chechnya and Russia sit. And all the information that the FBI or DHS or CIA, all the various tips that may not look like anything, they should go there. We don't know if they actually do. The CIA, when they file a report, as they did when Russia alerted them to his travel to Russia, that was pushed from the CIA into the National Counterterrorism Center and to the desk of the agents who sit and look at Chechnya and Chechen terrorism. We don't know because I don't think there is an automatic push mechanism to have the same thing happen from the FBI to the National Counterterrorism Center. And you have to wonder, why not? Because it's so much information. That's where you get the person who really understands what the questions are to ask and what might look suspicious. Just like the bin Laden incident, you had analysts who did nothing but study bin Laden, and they knew what little clues could amount to something important. And that's what does work. What doesn't work, it still seems, is when you have a vast array of people doing different things within their different organizations, not particularly expert in given areas or people, and sometimes missing what's important and not passing along things, which again happened here with the Border Patrol agent who was apparently informed about his trip to Russia and we don't think passed it on to the Boston Joint Terrorism Task Force there.
There's also, rudimentary questions. Here's a gut-checking moment that begins with the discussion of what might have gone wrong in the investigation of underwear bomber Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, and that may have persisted into the Tsarnaevs. Listen to these two.
Because the Nigerian guy's name was misspelled by one letter, he did not pop up. The little bits of data about him were not correlated. Those dots were not connected.
If you mistype something on Google, it says, did you mean this? Despite spending all the billions of dollars on databases, that simple spell check, did you mean this kind of software, wasn't operating.
So lawmaker Brad Miller and Richard Clark, once again, is spelling really an issue in this Tsarnaev case as far as you've been able to tell?
It really seems to be. And you have to wonder, why is it that they can't get what Google has? And one of the reasons, unfortunately, is the area of IT, information technology, is still a weakness within all these systems that have been created to store information and then somehow to filter them together. Things still don't talk to each other over at the NCTC. You have to still hop from system to system. And that is still a big problem.
And maddening to observe in the documentary tonight. Dana Priest is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The Washington Post, co-author of Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. She's one of the many experts interviewed in the new Frontline documentary, Top Secret America, 9/11 to the Boston Bombings, which airs tonight on PBS stations produced in partnership with WGBH. Dana, congratulations. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Look back at the calendar now. Many years don't have any books written about them. 1492 has a couple. 1789 has a zillion. 1787 has a few. 1800 has a couple. 1865 has a couple of books written about it. 1979 joins the pantheon of important years that may have set the stage for the decades in the future. A year of seismic change was 1979. Deng Xiaoping moved communist China to a market-based economy. Ayatollah Khomeini returned triumphantly to Iran, a nation we still don't have diplomatic relations with, years later. A young woman named Margaret Thatcher took the reins of power in Britain. Pope John Paul II inspired millions of Polish citizens living under communist rule and inspired what became the fall of the Soviet Union. The world certainly shifted in the late 70s. Journalist Christian Carroll argues that the year 1979 marked the turning point to our modern age. His new book is called Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century. He joins us today from Washington, D.C. Boy, it's quite a list. And welcome, Christian. It's quite a list what happened in 1979.
It is. And thank you, John, for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here.
Let's talk about what first clued you in that 79 was an intersection point for a whole variety of things that is happening today.
Well, it's important to emphasize that I am not a professional historian. I'm not a scholar, and I'm sure the book will show that for good and for bad. I am, in fact, a working journalist, and I got the idea for the book when I was a Newsweek correspondent covering the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I arrived in Afghanistan shortly after 9/11 and ended up in Kabul soon after that. And in early 2002, one of the things that struck me about Kabul was the way that a lot of the development that had occurred in Afghanistan, and especially in its capital, had occurred in the 1960s and 70s. All the big public buildings were built in the 70s. If you got a ride with someone, you found yourself driving around in a big American car from the 1970s. And basically, starting at the end of the 70s, history for Afghanistan began to run in reverse. Women in the 1960s and 70s in Kabul were perfectly okay walking around in burqas and short skirts, and it was one, like many other countries, a country that seemed to be on a path towards kind of secular modernization. And then something happened at the end of the decade, which was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And from that point on, it was downhill. Afghanistan fell apart. And when I was there, I found myself thinking about why this happened. And lo and behold, a few years later, I was in Iraq. Same thing, big American cars from the 1970s. You know, you're living in all the in houses that were built in the 1970s with, you know, stereos that have 8-track tape players in them. And you find yourself thinking, well, wait a minute, what happened here? And one of the things that happened there was in 1979. I don't talk about this much in the book because for a variety of reasons, it's not that interesting. But 1979, Saddam Hussein became president of Iraq. Mm. And shortly after that, he invaded Iran, which started an 8-year war. And then he invaded Kuwait, which started all the problems with the U.S. And Iraq also kind of, in a certain sense, ground to a halt. And you begin thinking about this moment at the end of the 1970s and think, what happened? And then you realize there were a lot of very interesting things going on in the world.
Well, you've got a story of things swept away, as you described there in Kabul. But there's also seeds sown that would bear extraordinary fruit in China, and particularly with the Pope John Paul II's confrontation of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, well, I think those stories are absolutely fascinating. And I think we've forgotten that a lot of these things happened at this particular moment. In many ways, the China story is the most interesting. I think that's the one I enjoyed doing the most in my book, because China scholars are brilliant, right? They know China so incredibly well, but they tend to know it so well, they tend to forget some of the really obvious things about it. And I just wanted to tell this story about this really incredibly dramatic moment when Deng Xiaoping takes power in China at the end of 1978. And then very quietly, he's telling other communists, leading members of the Communist Party, hey, you know what? We need to emphasize economic development, and that's going to mean some people get rich quicker than others, you know, which was just an unbelievably dramatic departure from Maoism, which was all about, you know, radical equality and, you know, we hate capitalism and it just can't happen. And here's the guy who is one of Mao Zedong's apostles quietly telling the Communist Party in the world's most populous country, you know, it just isn't working, so we got to try something else.
You know, it was
I just find that incredibly dramatic.
Well, it was quiet to Western observers and to maybe some of the China scholars, but, you know, with the Cultural Revolution in China right there in memory, fresh memory for the people of that nation, the brutal Cultural Revolution, to hear slogans like, to be rich is glorious, and it doesn't matter if a cat is black or white so long as it catches mice. I mean, those could not have been stated quietly in China at that moment.
Right, but the Deng, a lot of people at the time did understand that something significant was happening. The Chinese certainly got it. And I have a very nice interview in my book with a guy who was one of the very first private entrepreneurs who started his business in the city of Guangzhou in southern China in, I believe it was March 1979. So the Chinese themselves, oh, they totally got it. But what the outside world didn't understand was the potential momentousness of these changes. Nobody at the time would have, it would have occurred to no one to say, oh, you know, China is going to be a capitalist country in 20 years. The comparisons that people drew at the time with these very modest reforms that started the whole thing were with Yugoslavia, Hungary, even East Germany, which at that time was considered to be one of the reformist countries in the Soviet bloc. And, you know, the idea that this might ultimately lead China to being a capitalist country, a member of the World Trade Organization, people would have sent you to an insane asylum.
You know, on that question of interviews with people whose significance is hard to evaluate, you serendipitously ran across this fellow Misha on the Boston bombings who had contact with Tamerlane Tsarnaev, and you write about it, you know, it's coincident with the announcement of this book. Could you share with us any sense of his significance? The FBI seems to be ruling him out as a person of interest, but he certainly did have contact with this Armenian, had contact with Tamerlane Tsarnaev.
Well, thanks a lot for asking about that, John. This has just been the absolutely craziest week of my life. I certainly did not go off to Boston last week at the instigation of my editor at the New York Review of Books, thinking I was going to come away with this big story. Misha, I think his significance is that, I have to emphasize, when I talked to Misha, I came to his house. It was completely unexpected. He was completely flabbergasted that I was there. He had managed to kind of ride everything out in obscurity because nobody knew his actual name. And so when I talked to him, I tried to ask all the questions about the things we want to know. You know, how close was your relationship to Tamerlan? How Muslim are you? And so on and so forth. And these were all the sensitive things he didn't want to talk about. His family was trying to shoo me out the door. Don't talk about that. Don't talk about that. They were very, very anxious. So it's a little hard. There are a lot of open questions. I don't pretend that my interview answered any of the significant questions. But what I think is that he may have had an influence as far as helping Tamerlan to become more intense about his Islam. I'm inclined to be skeptical that Misha was some kind of, you know, Svengali who drove him to jihad. I just don't think that's likely.
It certainly gives you chills, and it must have given you chills. Quite a year for you, 2013. Christian Carroll is the author of Strange Rebels, 1979, and The Birth of the 21st Century. Thanks, Christian.
Thank you, John.
1994 was the year from this listener in Austin, Texas, began singing the blues in public and came out of my shell. Stay out of that shell, won't you? Give us your take on the best year of your life, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet, at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Henry Luce Foundation for Increased Understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway is produced by WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.